I call this meeting of the Committee on Public Safety, Finance, and Policy to order. There is a quorum present. Members, we have several bills on the agenda today, and as a reminder to the public, the only public testimony we'll be taking on the bills this evening is from individuals who signed up in advance per the agenda's posting on the committee webpage. Our first order of business is to approve the minutes for March 14th, 2023. Representative Hollins, would you like to move the minutes for March 14th?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've reviewed the minutes and I move for their approval.
All those in favor of the minutes, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the minutes for March 14th, 2023 are approved. First bill we're hearing today is House File 2465. It's a Representative Hewitt bill, and I will move to lay over House File 2465. Representative Hewitt, I believe you have an A1 amendment. Would you like to move and explain your amendment, please?
I would, Madam Chair. This amendment basically puts the bill in the shape I wanted in. It brings in, I believe, the two-year degree and another product for retired police officers.
All right. Any discussion to the A1 amendment? Representative Novotny.
Chair Maroli, just wondering about the routing of the bill. I believe it's under 43A, which would be stakeout.
At this point, we're planning on laying the bill over.
Thank you, Chair.
Any further discussion of the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the A1 amendment is adopted. All right, Representative Hewitt, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. It's going to be a busy night for you, and I'm glad you get to hear this excellent bill first. Madam Chair, I'd like to thank you for trusting me with this awesome responsibility to meet with the stakeholders and to find out how we can improve. There's no silver bullet to this. We are in a crisis with our police officers. They are leaving the force. If one gets hurt, unfortunately, we had a terrible situation in Eagan yesterday. We need to replace officers. And this will hopefully help with that. It will also give our officers an incentive to stick around. What the bill basically does, and I have two testifiers here with me, but on the front end, we're going to take the LIDO program from the State Patrol, which is basically finding people with a two-year degree or a four-year degree and putting them through the essentials of being a police officer. We'd have a department sponsor them, like a sheriff's office or a city. We would, the bill lets, we pay their salary during this time. We put them into the program, and we produce, hopefully, a police officer. The State Patrol are seeing promising signs with their program on this, and they're getting a very diverse group. So I look forward to seeing how that program grows with this one. So this opens it up statewide. The other part of the bill is a retention piece. And this is where we had some struggles to find out what's going to keep our officers on the job. And realistically, one of the problems they have is when they do retire, they actually don't have health insurance. Our state troopers do, but our officers in general and our sheriffs do not get it through the gap, what we call it. So if they retire at 52, they have to wait until they're 65 to get the Medicare part. So what we would be willing to do with the state program is cover their health insurance. For those that don't need that coverage, we've also added into the program a little stipend in there for their health care savings account for the years that they're in the gap. We would put $2,500 a year away in a health care savings account. Working with me on this bill was actually a joy because I got to see old friends. I got to meet new friends. MMPO, the Sheriff's Association, and the Minnesota Police Chiefs all had input on this. This was not a John Hewitt bill. This was basically John Hewitt listening to stakeholders. And I went up to a conference with our police officers recently, and that was probably the most interesting part, is to sit at a table and share a meal with them and them telling me what would work best to try to keep us on the job. A lot of great stories. Like I said, there's no silver bullet to this problem, but this could be a start. Tonight I have with me some great testifiers. My former sheriff, Tim Leslie, and Jeff Potts are here to talk about the bill a little bit and what it would mean to them.
All right, thank you. I have Jeff Potts on the schedule first, so welcome back. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Well, thanks, Madam Chair. My name is Jeff Potts, I'm the executive director for the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association and former police chief in the city of Bloomington. We want to thank Representative Hewitt for working with us. There's several stakeholders that were involved in the creation of this bill. I'll just give you the perspective from the Police Chiefs Association that recruitment and retention is probably one of the biggest issues facing departments across the state. This is not unique to the metro area. It's going on across the state. And, in fact, in the last 8 months, three police departments have closed their doors because they can't find applicants. Clara City, Ortonville, Morris, Minnesota, and all these are rural, smaller police departments. But the reality is 50% of the departments in Minnesota are fewer than 10 officers. And so this issue is real, and it's statewide. We think that both provisions in the bill will help. Certainly the health insurance provision we think will help keep those who are currently working in their role. Unfortunately, we've seen a lot of police officers leave early over the last couple of years, and I think this is a really good provision that will help them and also help them when they retire. The intensive comprehensive police officer education training program, modeled after LEADO, but very similar to the Pathway to Policing program that has been in existence for about 5 years. We think the expansion will help bring more people into law enforcement. There are significant benefits to them to come into it through this program. Most importantly is the educational requirements that they need to transition from one profession into another, that being law enforcement, while they can earn a wage in doing that. So we really appreciate Representative Hewitt for his work on this bill. We support this bill, and we thank him for bringing this forward, and we think it will make a difference. Thanks, Madam Chair, members, for allowing me to testify here today.
Yeah, thank you. And next up, we have Sheriff Tim Leslie. So go ahead and introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Tim Leslie. I represent the Minnesota Sheriff's Association. I was a two-term sheriff in Dakota County. Prior to that, I spent time elsewhere, Department of Public Safety and St. Paul Police Department. We are here in support, representing the 87 elected sheriffs across this state. And I just did a real quick survey of sheriffs before I came to testify. And he used the term crisis. So I had that written. I changed it now as to peril. I thought that might be a little more accurate. The sheriff in Pine County, 6 applicants for 3 jobs. The sheriff in another county was 12 applicants for 6 jobs, 50-50. You know, if you're playing roulette, that's pretty good. And then the sheriff in Meeker County, who sat here and testified 2 weeks ago, Sheriff Brian Cruz, three applicants for 4 jobs. Now, I'm not a math major, but that is not sustainable. He then told his county board, we are going to have to get rid of 24-hour coverage if something doesn't change. The bill that Representative Hewitt has moved forward will change this leak that we're having with people leaving early. I think it'll help sustain some retention issues. The other part of the bill that will bring people into the profession is also equally as important. The first obligation of government is public safety. And so if you dial 911 and no one comes, that's a failure. So thank you for hearing me out. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much. And we did not have anyone from the public sign up in advance to testify, so we will go ahead and move to member discussion. But before we do, I'll just note my appreciation too for Representative Hewitt for working on this bill. I know when I started to meet with some of the different law enforcement groups at the beginning of session, I kept hearing recruiting and retaining as being like the top issue and was desperate for language that we could put forward, and Representative Hewitt stepped up to work on that bill, and I'm very appreciative for that. Member discussion. Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Have we established what the payback will be on the loan program?
Representative Hewitt.
Representative Novotny could do it.
Yeah. Consecutive years.
I'm sorry. What was the question again?
What will the consecutive years be for payback? It's blank under the bill.
We don't have that yet. We're also waiting for the fiscal note on this still. It's been ordered as soon as the bill was out, and we're still waiting for all those fine details. But I'm optimistic, sir.
Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mueller.
Any further discussion to the bill? All right. Closing comments, Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, committee, and thank you, Chair, for hearing the bill tonight. I think this is just a start. Naturally, I do look forward I am still working hard to try to get some bipartisan support on this. I think we can get there. I'm looking for your input. And let's take the first step and get something like this working. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And with that, I'll renew my motion and lay over House File 1415 as amended. Sorry. Said the wrong thing. 2465 as amended. All right, the next bill on our agenda is House File 1415. It is a Representative Curran bill, and I will move to lay over House File 1415. Representative Curran, I believe you have an author's amendment. It's a DE1 amendment. And because it's a DE1, I think it makes sense for us to just go straight to the vote rather than have you explain it. So all those in favor of the DE1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the DE1 amendment is adopted. All right, and please go ahead and tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, committee members, for being here tonight to hear this bill. So House File 1415 does a couple of things. First, it allows for the Adler Graduate School of Counseling to provide additional training for mental health practitioners. And the goal of this is that that professionals are specifically trained to work with the law enforcement community with the very specific, unique needs that folks go through in this work. And we know that we have a significant need to treat PTSD. We've had a lot of conversations about that in this committee. And so this program is one that is a specialty program specifically to license mental health professionals to provide quality services to law enforcement families. Personnel and families. The other aspect of this bill would allow a grant program so that police departments, if they wanted to have mental health practitioners have visits with their officers, that they would be able to apply for a grant for those services. And I've spoken with a number of communities in my own district. I know that they're taking advantage currently of just partnership with other departments in the area, and they're just splitting the cost on their own of having an in-house practitioner who gets to know their officers. And so I see this as a way to establish a pool of very qualified individuals and then get those individuals available to those departments and then have departments actually have a way to pay for that. So I see this as a jumping off point for some future work to be had as well. With that, I'll turn it over to testifiers.
Thank you. And first up, we have Leanne Renteria. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Leanne Renteria. I currently work as a mental health practitioner in St. Paul. I'm here to speak on behalf of law enforcement officers who have struggled with mental health. All my life, I've been surrounded by police officers, my grandfather, my father, uncles, cousins, friends. I became a police officer and I married one. I have clients who are police officers. Police officers see the worst of people and they see good people at their worst. No one walks away from police work unscathed. Growing up, I watched my father struggle with migraines. His heart would pound. He thought he was having a heart attack. He worried a lot. He isolated on his days off. He sought out several medical professionals, but he was continually told that his symptoms were all in his head. He continued to suffer like this for most of his career. It eventually took his life. I took a great deal of pride in being a police officer. Like most, I found myself gravitating towards other officers in my free time. It is a challenge to find people who really understand what it's like to work in law enforcement. It was in police work that I met my husband. Shortly before our wedding, my husband was involved in a fatal car accident on the job. Our lives were changed forever. At first, we tried to power through, but eventually our mental health suffered. We were referred to counseling, but weren't ready to accept the help. In police work, having a mental health issue is a sign of weakness. Officers are told to suck it up and get over it. Trauma is just part of the job. After a few months, we decided we were fine and we stopped going to counseling. Then my husband lost his job and we lost ourselves. We tried just about everything we could to cope, but it didn't matter. Our past traumas and the impact from the accident took a toll on our relationship. When we finally hit rock bottom, we had a five-month-old little girl, and we wanted to do better for her. She's here today. When we went back to therapy, we did what they told us to do. We trusted the counselors because they had extensive knowledge of police work and police families. As my mental health improved, so did my interactions with citizens. I became a better person, and I became a better police officer. Police work is really hard. Most people don't understand what officers go through. When seeking support, most officers want professionals who understand police work and the mental health issues specific to their field. They need someone on their side. Most police officers have determination and integrity. They want to get better. Perhaps we need to focus on keeping the good officers we have and create a positive environment that will draw in new recruits. We need more therapists trained to give these professionals the support they need so in turn they can do the best work possible. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. We appreciate you being here today. Next up we have Scott Borboom. If you can introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Good evening, Madam Chair and community members. My name is Scott Borboom, and I'm the Chief of Police for the City of Minnetonka. Thank you for having me here tonight on this very important topic. As you're well aware, there's a lot of attention around law enforcement mental health, and we are all trying to identify strategies to better support our officers. As the Chief of Police in Minnetonka, I take officer wellness very seriously, and we have identified several strategies in Minnetonka to improve officer wellness. One in particular is our annual checkup from the neck up, which we started in 2022. Annually, all police staff, not just our sworn officers, but our non-sworn officers, will participate in a meeting with a therapist, a one-on-one for 1 hour. This is just to do a check-in. And then upon request, the officer or staff person, the non-sworn, can request up to 12 additional sessions at our cost. We have budgeted $25,000 annually to contract with two therapists. When researching therapists to provide this service, the pool was very limited, especially with those that have experience working with law enforcement officers. I do believe it's improving. However, there still is a need for more therapists trained in working with law enforcement. When approached by the Adler Graduate School, which is in Minnetonka, about this bill, I was pleased to see a focus on training additional therapists on the unique challenges a law enforcement officer faces. While this will certainly benefit the metro area, I believe it will have a greater impact on greater Minnesota police officers by providing more mental health professional resources in these areas. Training more therapists on the unique set of stressors our police officers face will provide more resources for those officers in need, and therefore I support this bill. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. We appreciate it. We did not have any members of the public sign up to testify, so we'll move to member discussion. Representative Whitty.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Thank you, Representative Curran, for reading this bill forward. I appreciate your story because taking the time out to share it, a lot of law enforcement personnel don't because, like you said, the weakness part. And I'm glad that Minnetonka has a program. I think more police departments are taking care of their own. My one question would be firefighters in this. Is just when you say this is just a jumping off part, is that what you mean eventually into the fire stations?
Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. And so, yes, that is a piece of it. So my ultimate goal would be that we have resources for everyone who works in a first responder capacity, who sees this, you know, very unique set of circumstances that lead to this kind of trauma. And so this particular program in the funding of the Adler Graduate School is specific to the policing profession so that they can address that issue specifically because, as we know, there are unique things to PTSD, but then there are also unique things to policing. And there's culture involved in all of that. So we want to make this part of that culture and starting there. So the funding for the program would be specifically for practitioners who would work with law enforcement personnel, but I believe the grant program would apply to other first responders.
Representative Whitty.
Thank you. Yes, law enforcement sees about 850 critical incidents a year. So whatever we can do to help them. But it also starts with our community and how we treat them. So hopefully our community can stays behind our officers as they go through this program. Thank you.
Further member discussion? Representative Frazier.
Thank you for bringing this bill, Representative Curran. Good to see you, sir. I don't know if we had a meeting recently, but I must have missed it, but I'll be there. I'll be back soon. Thank you for sharing your story. I appreciate that. That's important. You know, we ask our police officers to hold so much. Representative, what you just said was, how many? 850 critical incidents a year. And we're asking them to hold those things in. And we're creating a space where we're saying, you know what, you're weak if you talk about those things. You're weak if you don't find some time to find someone to help you work through those things so you can go out there and do your job the best way possible. We have to create a space that says otherwise. And I think this bill was working toward doing that, so thank you for bringing it. And I'm hoping it makes the impact that I believe it can make. Because I know we've got some people, some very good people that are serving, that are wearing that badge, and all they want to do every day is go out and help people and save people. And we have to be able to make sure that we're taking care of them. So thank you for bringing this bill.
Further member discussion? Lead Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Thank you, Representative Curran, for bringing this forward and the testifiers. Just a couple technical questions that I have. It describes an 11-county metro area as opposed to the 7-county metro area. What are the 11 counties?
Representative Curran.
That is a great question. Can you point to the line that you're looking at?
Representative Novotny.
I had it in the original one at the DC.
Oh, it's line, 2.21 and 2.22.
Okay, thank you, Chair. That is a great question, and I will say this language was adopted from a bill that was introduced by Representative Stevenson, and we married these together so that we thought that this was a really good way to start this program. So I will get back to you on what that includes, but I will say that I'm glad that it is larger than 7 counties.
Lead Nabani.
Thank you, Chair Mueller, and just one last thing, kind of piggybacking on what Representative Witte said, this is a first responder bill. What hasn't been mentioned here and I think is important is our other partner. We talk about the peace officers, we talk about the firefighters, and the shout out to Representative Hewitt, if he's still here, but I'd be remiss if I didn't bring up a friend of mine, JT, who was a paramedic and struggled with this, and we ultimately lost JT to suicide. So I would need to get them included too. So thank you.
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. And just really quick, I have the benefit of having the computer in front of me so I can Google the 11 county metro. It's Anoka, Carver, Chisago, Dakota, Hennepin, Isanti, Ramsey, Scott, Sherburn, Washington, and Wright. So you don't have to do that.
Okay. Representative Gotti. Great. Thanks for that. I don't see any other members, so please go ahead with your closing comments.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you again, Committee. I really appreciate the attentive discussion, not only to this bill, but to the broader issue that we've discussed and all the programs that we've talked about to help folks out. So I appreciate the continued discussion, and I really thank our testifiers for coming and talking about this. And I know how difficult it is to talk about these stories over and over again, and I just want to acknowledge that and appreciate that in this moment. So with that, I ask for your support. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you once again to the testifiers. We do really appreciate you being here. And with that, I renew my motion and lay over House File 1415 as amended. The next bill on our agenda is House File 2290, also a Representative Curran bill. And Representative Curran, I believe your motion is that House File 2290 be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law.
Yes, Chair, that is my motion.
All right. And that you do have the A1 amendment. Would you like to move and explain the A1 amendment?
Yes, Chair. I would like to move the A1 amendment, and I will describe it for everyone here. So a little bit behind, I'll give some backstory to this. So interestingly, a knock warrant is defined by what it isn't. So we don't have a statute that says what is a warrant outside of defining what a no-knock is. So this statute being the place where that occurs, I've amended the language so that a traditional warrant could be announced using other methods. This could include the use of technology, a telephone, a megaphone, simply distance between law enforcement and the subject. And so this takes away the traditional knuckles to door and creates safer space and actually creates more flexibility in how we can execute warrants. And it also changes the amount of time required to wait following that announcement. Of course, in statute currently, it's required to wait 30 seconds. And anyone who works in a first responder type situation knows that 20 seconds can be life-altering or life-saving. So I think it's important that we change that language so that it's consistent with a host of policing case law and use the term reasonable. And that will also allow this statute hopefully to hold up some flexibility over time.
All right, thank you. Discussion to the A1 amendment. Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. The A1 amendment is adopted. And if you could please tell us about your bill as amended.
Yes, thank you, Chair, and thank you, committee, again for hearing this bill. So I just wanted to start a little bit with the context of our Constitution. And I'll speak just briefly. When I was in school for law enforcement, I thought studying the Constitution was one of the neatest things that I had this experience of doing because it truly is a living document, and it's something that has really stood the test of time in the language that was used. But I want to acknowledge that over time we've become accustomed to some laws that arguably infringe on some of our constitutional rights in one way or another. Now, I know we might not always agree when that is the case or which give and take might be worth it at some times. But I think we all know that our Fourth Amendment right to freedom from unlawful search and seizure is what gives us the very crucial and personal right to privacy. Without fear of sudden government intrusion or criminal acts, we have laws that protect us from those things. So these laws that we have uplift our constitutional rights to peace in our own homes. So today I'm here to ask the committee a pretty specific question, and that is the pursuit of justice worth death when it's avoidable? And, you know, considering that question as we move on, just to try to think about that. We know that emergencies don't require warrants. Exigent circumstances allow law enforcement to pursue without a warrant. That's because in an emergency, we know for certain what the right thing is to do. Protect, save, get everyone home safe. I recognize that a total prohibition of no-knock warrants has not always been the most well-received idea. It's not the most popular idea. And I have to admit it took me a long time to decide which version of this bill to present. I had a lot of discussions with a lot of folks in different realms. But I'm asking this committee here today to reframe the way that we think about this issue. This is about our rights. It's about our right to know for certain that when someone enters your home unannounced, you don't need to second guess if that person might be a police officer. Your right to protect your home, your privacy, is something that cannot be taken away from you. And I think we really need to dig deep when we ask ourselves what we're willing to pay for the pursuit of justice. Because I don't think the answer includes the lives of police officers, innocent bystanders, or people who are in the right place but on the wrong sheet of paper. I understand there's gonna be questions, there's gonna be hypotheticals and layered hypotheticals, I assume. And I look forward to the discussion. But before you ask those questions, I just ask that you take a pause and ask yourself if that situation is really worth putting police officers and innocent people in serious danger. Is the situation truly worth impeding our rights to privacy in our own homes? Because we are all one fake credit application or case of identity theft away from getting caught in this kind of situation. Now, please consider the next testimony as you weigh the true importance of entering a home unannounced when no one inside is in imminent danger.
Thank you. And our testifier is Mr. Andre Locke. If you could come forward, please. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Locke.
Hello. Thank you all for having me.
And if you could, before you begin your testimony, introduce yourself. You might need to pull that mic down.
Oh, okay. Not a problem.
Great. Thank you.
I am Andre Locke, Sr., father of Amir Locke. Let's see. I'm just going to set you right here. Sorry. Thank you, Chair Mueller and members of the Public Safety Finance and Policy Committee. My name is Andre Locke. I am the father of Amir Locke. I'm here today to speak in support of House File 2290, the prohibition of no-knock warrants in Minnesota. I implore you to vote in favor of this legislation. My son, Amir Locke, life mattered. He mattered. He was 22 years old and was laying the groundwork for a meaningful life, helping make the world a better place. And now we have to do that in his name. He was a beautiful son. He had a great sense of humor. He loved music. And he had an unforgettable smile. He was truly loved. In the early morning hours of February the 2nd, 2022, a little more than a year ago, Amir was awoken by a no-knock warrant executed by the Minneapolis SWAT team. Amir was not named in that warrant, not suspected of any crime, and was a guest at the residence where he was sleeping. Upon being woken up by the invading SWAT team, Amir reached for his handgun, demonstrating proper and responsible handling by keeping the handgun pointed down, keeping his finger off of the trigger, and never raising the weapon in the direction of any officer. Minneapolis police, without warning, denied my son the ability to assess the situation and disarm himself, fired three times, three shots, while Amir was still covered in a blanket on the couch where he had been resting peacefully. Within 10 seconds of the SWAT team entering the apartment, Amir was gone. No-knock warrants, like the one that resulted in Amir's senseless death, is an issue that Minnesota and our entire nation need to deal with. We've seen over and over again across the country in ways in which these raids result in unnecessary damage, injury, and death. We call on our leaders to do the right things and eliminate or significantly restrict the militaristic approach in policing our communities. Representative Omar has introduced the Amir Locke no-knock warrant reform bill in Congress. And now these brave lawmakers here in Minnesota are stepping up to do the right thing and save lives. Minnesota has a responsibility to its citizens to ensure police officers are properly trained and understand how to de-escalate interactions with civilians and value human life. This tragedy was avoidable if the city abided by its promise to cease performing these dangerous and unnecessary no-knock warrants. Shooting Amir under these circumstances without warning or opportunity to comply is unreasonable force under the Fourth Amendment. Our hearts are broken, and there is nothing in the world that will make that better. Amir was a beautiful 22-year-old man with his whole life to be lived, and we'll never know that. We'll never know his contribution, what it would be, and how he would have made the world a better place. I apologize. We now fight for justice in his name and hope meaningful change will be his legacy. Thank you for your support over this life-changing legislation.
Mr. Locke, thank you so much, and our deepest sympathies to you and your family, and our great appreciation for you being here today. It really does matter, and we appreciate it.
Thank you.
We did not have any members of the public sign up to testify, so we can move on now to member discussion. Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Chair Mueller, and thank you, Representative Kern, for taking this on. We don't often get to see in this body how our work really impacts people. And I carried the no-knock warrant bill in 2021. And I will always regret not pushing harder for that ban, because I honestly feel the weight of Amir Locke's death on my shoulders every single day. And I don't wish that on any of you to have to feel what that feels like. I want to thank you for being here. I want to thank the family for being here. And I want to apologize for not doing more in 2021 and for not being able to get it across the finish line when we could have saved his life. Beyond my emotions, I have a couple of points that I would like to, a couple of facts that I would like to point out. No-knock warrants are most frequently, most often defended by, or said they're needed by law enforcement in counties where they're not even really being used. And so I want to make sure that we're addressing that because it is a dangerous and costly tactic that is not being used in a lot of parts of greater Minnesota. And there's reason for that. I know I'm from a small town and you know people in small towns and you don't need to use them as often because you know what you're walking into. But they are being used here in the Twin Cities frequently and our community members are dying from it. And I know that usually the argument against that is that if it's only being used here in the Twin Cities, then why do we need to ban it statewide? And I'm going to address that argument really quickly because the very no-knock warrant that was used in Amir Locke's death was one that involved multiple counties because one county issued it, the other one executed it. The one that issued it, it did not issue a no-knock warrant. They issued a regular warrant. The county that executed it decided that they needed a no-knock warrant in that situation. And so we really do need uniformity across the state if we want to see fewer deaths because of this. So, I mean, that's a perfect example. We all live too close to each other to be making decisions based on one county or the other, and especially when we're talking about one county executing another warrant that a county has issued. The other thing I want to point out that I don't know if it had been mentioned, but almost 45% of Minnesotans are lawful gun owners. And so when we think about that number, we're honestly putting our law enforcement officers at risk, asking them to burst into a space where almost 50% of them will have guns. And I don't know about you, but if you bust into my house in the middle of the night, chances are I'm probably gonna pull my gun on you. And I don't wanna ask officers to be put into a situation where there's a 50% chance that they're gonna be shot. I think that's irresponsible of us as a city, as a county, as a state. And that's why I'm in support of this piece of legislation. I believe that it will save lives, and I believe that we have a whole plethora of other tactics that we can use other than no-knock warrants that have been shown to work in other cities, in other states. So I hope that you will all join me in supporting this bill, and I really want to thank Representative Curran for taking this on when I just did not have the emotional capacity to do it again. So thank you.
Thank you. Other member comments? Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Out of respect, I want to try to tread lightly here. At the same time, we have a responsibility to make sure that we're approaching this issue objectively and thoroughly and from all the relevant perspectives. So let me set a ground rule for myself, at the very least. Let's assume that the policymakers and the law enforcement officers and the judges and all the folks that have been entrusted with some degree or another of public trust in this process are good people with good intentions, reasonable judgment, competency, and the desire to do the right thing, the best thing for all parties concerned. Under that assumption, some interesting questions arise. So it's been stated that these no-knock warrants are unnecessary that they place officers and the subjects of warrants and folks who are around the situation at unnecessary and aggravated risk, then why does anybody seek them? And that's a rhetorical question. I'm not looking for your answer. Why would officers, I mean, you just, Representative Hollins just related a story of one county issuing a warrant that was not a no-knock warrant, the county where it was being executed taking that warrant and deciding that they wanted a no-knock warrant. They wanted it. They wanted, under the premises that have been stated here tonight, to place themselves at aggravated and unnecessary risk. Now, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. Generally speaking, I'd like to think that police officers want to come home every night. So why would they actively seek, take an extra step to try to put themselves at aggravated and unnecessary risk? I think the answer is, and also because there's another party involved here, and that's the judges. Judges who are tasked with looking at the evidence that's been presented to them and making a decision as to whether or not to sign off on that warrant. The cops can't do it by themselves. And let's also just focus on what a warrant is. You know, the Representative Curran started out the presentation talking about the Constitution. And you're absolutely right. Fourth Amendment, strong stuff that we ought to be protecting. But that's what a warrant is. A warrant is saying that we have reason to encroach upon what would otherwise be protected space and even your person. An arrest warrant says that I can come find you and take you into custody and you're going to lose your freedom. Now, if there wasn't a reason for that, if there wasn't warrant for that, that would be a crime. That would be kidnapping and imprisonment, false imprisonment. So clearly, it should not be a revelation that there are circumstances that exist. There's probable cause. There are reasons that warrant. That's why we use that word. In particular cases where a person has been identified and is suspected of particular activity, to take action against them that would not otherwise be appropriate. And so, you know, in the space between, there's a KSTP article from February 2022 that looks at data that was collected as a result of action taken by this body. Between September of 2021 and February of 2022, there were 70 no-knock warrants issued. So that's just that number. There's 70 times officers sought and judges agreed with presented evidence that this was the appropriate, proper thing to do. And under all of the presumptions that I started off with, that everybody's acting in good faith, everyone's reasonable, everybody's competent, rationally, they determined that of all the bad choices, of all the bad approaches to the problem, this was the least bad. Because in their judgment, having any sort of, what this says is that if we let this person know we're coming for them, they are going to take whatever amount of time they are granted to mount a defense against us, which might include taking a hostage, which will certainly most likely include arming themselves, getting at the ready, being prepared to fight. And so in order to stave that off, we're not going to give them any warning that we're coming. We're not going to announce it. 70 times in that short space, that's 5 months, I believe, officers sought that and a judge agreed that that was the right thing to do. Of those 70 warrants, only 49 of them were executed as no-knock warrants. So officers decided that even though they had the ability to engage in what's being described as an aggravated and unnecessarily dangerous activity, they decided to pull it back, which again demonstrates professional concern, reasonableness, judgment in the moment based on the circumstances that they're aware of. What we didn't see between September 2021 and February 2022 is 70 or more people killed. We didn't see massive mayhem, death, and destruction as a result of those 70 no-knock warrants. We saw the successful execution of warrants. And you're right, we don't always get to see the benefit of the work that we do in this chamber. In fact, when it's done well, we often never see it at all because it doesn't make the headlines. I feel as though this bill is legislating to the exception. This bill is legislating to the headlines. This bill is rooted in emotion, and it is not rooted in outcomes. And for that reason, I cannot support it. Thank you.
Representative Kern, would you like to comment?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Hudson. There's a lot to unpack in your statement, but there's a few things that I would like to address. And you know, the way that you framed it, I understand where you're coming from. And the reason, one of the reasons that I don't have a law enforcement testifier tonight is because I am that law enforcement testifier. I'm very well versed in everything that you're talking about and have actually experienced the things that we're talking about. I haven't myself been on a no-knock warrant because we know that they are rare. They're not used a lot. But what I will say is, you know, you're asking the question, why are we going to these lengths to put ourselves at great risk? And I ask the same question. I am literally asking that same question. Why are we doing this? So when we're talking about, you know, officers, you know, leadership who are applying for these warrants, we're talking about the judges who approve them. What's happening there is, you know, they're not necessarily evaluating what is the right thing to do. They're looking at available options and saying what options are available to us that are also legal. So in this case, when we have no-knock warrants legal, that is an option on the table. And I go back to the question that I asked everybody at the beginning is, at what point do we decide that enough is enough? How many lives is too many, and how many is enough? One was too many, and it's not just in Minnesota. And, you know, we do need to account for emotions when we talk about these things, because we have a family here tonight who's down one. And that's a big emotion. That's big, and that's important, and we can't ignore that. So, like I said, there is a lot to unpack there. I am very well aware of what our options are when it comes to warrants. I am also very well aware that when we know a member of our community is in need, when they are in need of rescue, when they are in need of life-saving efforts, nothing will stop us from getting to that person. We're not going to ask a judge if we can go save somebody's life today. That's just what we do. So, again, I ask, what is the reason for the unnecessary risk? Why are we considering that an option when we know that it can lead to death, and not just of innocent folks, but of police officers who are just doing their job? And I will say that when you ask a police officer to do their job, you are asking them to be willing to die at any point, any day, and that is something that never goes away. So it's not just specific to warrants. If you ask a police officer, will you go and do this for us? The answer is yes. The answer is always yes, because you do not say no when it comes to protecting and serving. That's part of the job. So what I'm asking is to take this option off of the table.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Representative Curran, you've worked as a police officer. I have worked as a prosecutor, work as a prosecutor. And I want to make sure we're clear here. So our state's second largest city, the one we're in right now, and I do sometimes hear from colleagues about crime in the metro area, we do not use no-knock warrants. I should say we, the St. Paul Police Department, does not use them. Doesn't use them. Blanket policy. And really that's what we're talking about here, is establishing a policy for the state. We had some discussion about what sort of choices, you know, individual departments making individual choices, et cetera, and it is our job to set policy for the state. And in this city, no matter what the circumstances are, there's no no-knock warrant. How can that be? Does St. Paul have just, or is there no dangerous situation in St. Paul? Well, no, I hear from my colleagues on the other side of the aisle, that's actually not true. There are dangerous situations in St. Paul. Two ways, two paths, right? One is that if you have a situation where a search needs to be conducted, you can get a warrant, but the other option is to have exigent circumstances. That's the other possibility, and Representative Curran alluded to that. If somebody is in danger in a given situation, if there's evidence that is that's in danger of being destroyed, even that, these are exigent circumstances where there is a waiver of the need to have a warrant. So any scenario you have in mind where that kind of situation is happening, you're not going to use a no-knock warrant at all. You're not going to use a warrant, right? Because exigent circumstances, just head on in. But what if there are circumstances where it would, in fact, be dangerous for officers to be to be, you know, walking on in. Well, I have read many police reports, many situations where officers send in robots. They send, they've got all sorts of things. They announce to somebody, make sure to call people out. There's a variety of techniques that are used to keep everyone safe. And the question for our public safety committee, we have jurisdiction over the whole state, right, is to say what should the policy be for the state? And it seems to me it makes great sense that if this is working well in St. Paul, which it is, that it's something that keeps everyone safe around the state to have this policy to advance. And I have to say, I feel like I picked up a little bit in the discussion somehow that you were looking to the situation where Amir Locke lost his life, and somehow sort of looking to that as some, this is a situation where different decisions are made, different counties communicate with one another. I would hope that that's not a model for us, right? This is a situation where somebody lost his life. And every one of these situations where somebody, where officers would be bursting in is a situation that's extraordinarily dangerous. We want to make sure to eliminate as much of that danger as we possibly can. As Representative Curran said, if there is somebody whose life is in danger, if there's exigent circumstances, officers are going to do what they need to do. This warrant, this doesn't apply. They need to get a warrant in that situation. And then otherwise, we want to say we want to be as safe as possible. And bursting into a home where there's not exigent circumstances and there's not a warning to people inside that home is a recipe for disaster, and we have seen it in our state. Thank you, Representative Curran. Thank you, Representative Hollins, for your work. This is the right thing to do to keep people safe in our state. We should advance it. Thank you.
Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Chair Mueller, and thank you, Representative Grant, for bringing this forward, because it does allow us to have this further discussion and to explore your original statement. I think you're bringing this forward in good faith, and I understand that this brings a lot of emotions on both sides of it. But you had originally stated that you questioned, is the pursuit of justice worth death when avoidable? And when I was thinking about that, I couldn't help but think about our community, my home community, community that you represent now, in White Bear Lake. And recently, in late July, White Bear Lake Police Department, they were responding to a felony domestic assault, and Officer Sheik had knocked. He announced. And he then was shot, still in recovery. Is the pursuit of justice worth death when avoidable? Now, thank God that Officer Sheik is still with us. But could it have been avoided in the first place that a shot was fired? Had he have been offered the opportunity to cut out the unknowns from that interaction, I very well could be. And so a full-on ban does not allow the discretion that Representative Hudson was speaking about when he said that this is something that they examine in the line of duty when they're responding, as they see developments, and a full-on ban I just simply can't support. But I really appreciate the discussion. I want to hear more. I just urge that the committee take that into consideration as we pursue a proper way of examining this. So thank you.
Representative Hearn.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Engen. I appreciate your comments. And, Ryan, Officer Sheik, I know him. I worked with him at the department. We were up for that job at the same time. I could have been there. I trained another officer who was shot at in that situation. Hired and trained him as a reserve, and I was his reserve sergeant. So that is to say that, you know, these are issues that are close to all of us, but this is also, to your point, exercising a warrant is dangerous stuff in the first place. Officer Sheik got shot after announcing and knocking on a door. So to me, that says if we're trying to give every warning we can and it's deadly, why on earth are we taking more risk? Why on earth are we barging into someone's home where almost 50% of people own guns? Because I can guarantee you, if somebody were to break into my home at night, if somebody came in unannounced because my address was on the wrong piece of paper, I'm gonna feel terrible if the person I shot was the police officer. But I can tell you that I'll protect my own home, just as many people do. And I would hate to have to hesitate to figure out if that is an officer so that my wife or I lose our lives in the meantime, in those seconds, I would do what I needed to do to protect my family. And so I think we need to apply that to everybody. We need to put ourselves in a situation where we are in the right place, but somebody has the wrong information. And imagine what that's like as a family to have this intrusion happen to you. And I would point as well to, you know, we have the 2021 no-knock warrant report. In those cases, there were, I think it's 132 no-knocks that were applied for. And in those situations, there were 42 children involved in those situations, 42. So we also have to think about the additional collateral that we're talking about here. It's not just officers. It's not just the subject of the warrant. It's family members and it's children. We are effectively introducing children to law enforcement in a way that scars them for life and immediately places distrust between that child and law enforcement. They don't see them as a protector. They don't understand what's going on. So I think it's important that we acknowledge the full picture of what it is to be exercising a warrant. It is inherently dangerous. Policing is inherently dangerous. Wearing a uniform is inherently dangerous. There are some things in this situation that won't go away. Policing is dangerous. But if we can take a little fraction of that away, and at the same time acknowledging that when we're redefining what a knock is and eliminating that wait period, We're giving ourselves more flexibility. We really are, and I hope that people will take advantage of that.
And just to follow up, that the police call that was referenced, that wasn't a search warrant situation, if I'm not mistaken. That was an exigent circumstance. That was somebody called, as opposed to a search warrant that's obtained in order to try to, I'm losing my voice, I'm sorry, in order to try to gather evidence, which most of these no-knock warrants are for the search of evidence. So that was a very different situation where there were exigent circumstances. So that wouldn't be impacted by the bill that we're working on here today. We have next on the list, we have a few other members signed up to testify, Representative Frazier. Or to ask questions, sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Curran, thank you for bringing this. I've been around, and I was around when Rep. Hollins carried the bill before, and we didn't get as far as we should have. But because of the work she did, we have this no-knock warrant report that we have here. So we have more details about who's asking for these warrants, how many are being executed, who's involved, who's being harmed. We have that now. And I always say, when you have more data, when you are more informed, you should make smarter decisions. That's what we should do, right? And I can really appreciate you presenting this bill, because this was the work that you did. This was the career that you had chose to be a servant and do it in this manner. And so you have a perspective that many of us don't have. I know some of my colleagues on that side have it, but I always appreciate that perspective when it's shared and when it comes from someone that's been in those shoes. Just had to make some decisions. So I really appreciate you bringing this bill and having this conversation and everything that you've shared. And also, even with the stories that have been mentioned, you have a personal connection to those stories. And you're still here sharing this and trying to inform us on a way to move forward in a way that could save more lives, which in fact is part of our job, is to provide for public safety for the state, for all people in this state. And this is one of the ways that we can do that. You know, Mr. Locke, you know, you said you don't have to come down. You don't have to come down. You said earlier that you were sorry for getting emotional about the loss of a mayor. You don't ever have to be sorry, because this is something that we can prevent. This is something we should have prevented. So I just thank you for coming here and sharing your piece and continuing to memorialize and lift your son up, because we need to hear it. We should hear it every single day until we do something about it. So thank you for being here. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
You know, one of the other things we know about from the no-knock warrant report is that there's some disparities in who these no-knock warrants are executed against. You know, the data tells us, you know, you got it right there in front of you, but the data tells us that disproportionately these no-knock warrants are executed or requested for BIPOC people. You know, that's another issue that we're dealing with, right? Population-wise, it shouldn't be that way. It should go the other way for the highest population in our state, but it doesn't. So that's another issue that we're dealing with disparities, and we're dealing with addressing some inequities that we have in the way our system works. That's also important. I'll just close and say, you know, when we have the opportunity to put policies in place to make them uniform across the state so that we're saving lives, it shouldn't be a hard decision. It's not hard for me. I'm absolutely supporting this bill. Thank you.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to say I'm not really going to talk very much about the bill, but I did wanted to have on the record, Representative Curran, you told us that the reason you didn't have a police officer or law enforcement here for testifying is because you are the law enforcement testifying. And so I appreciate the work that you do. Thank you for your service. I did want to say on the record, however, in your packets, you do have a letter that was signed by the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association, the Minnesota Sheriff's Association, and the Minnesota Chief of Police Association, all three, which represent thousands of people who are boots on the ground, who do this work every day, all three have opposed this bill. And so that's all I wanted to say. I just wanted to get that on the record. Thank you, Sheriff Miller.
Yeah, thank you. And that's actually a good reminder. I meant to remind folks that we did have other letters in the packet as well. And I had a question about one of the other letters in the packet from the National Tactical Officers Association. I noted that this letter said, agencies initially used no-knock search warrants to protect the officer from violence and preserve evidence for the prosecution. Though the intent sounds reasonable and is noble in theory, the practice is flawed at its very core. I found this letter to be very compelling, and something that Representative Holland said earlier about other tactics being available, and that's mentioned a couple times. I'd love to hear from you what some of the other tactics are that are available.
Sure. Thank you, Chair. And I appreciate the comments, and I just wanted to address Representative Mueller. Yes, I have been in contact, we're in contact. I'm happy to look at language. There is another stop for this. I don't intend to make large changes to this bill, but I will say that I am open to discussion and open to education on both ends of this issue. So I have reached out to see if there's some language that we could agree on there. And I will say thank you, Chair, for the question. I go back to what we're really looking at its core, a couple of things. We're looking at our constitutional right to privacy in our own homes. And we're looking at the danger that no-knocks pose to the public and to officers. I would say that with the bill as amended now, this actually opens up more so than what NTOA had described in their initial release. There are other ways that we can do this business. And Representative Pinto had mentioned, you know, there's equipment. There's literally equipment that we can use when we need to. And I think with the language change specifically in this bill, that opens it up so that we actually can communicate with people in a variety of ways. Like I said, a telephone. We could clear an entire apartment building and yell at a subject from down the hall if we needed to. That would be considered a knock now. Alerting somebody and giving them the opportunity to become alert. And there are so many ways to do that. It would be difficult to describe all of them here today. But I hope that answers your question, that there are so many ways that we can do this work. And also important to mention that people eventually leave their homes at some time. People go outside. There are other ways to encounter people other than within their home or where they're believed to be. So there are other ways we can do this. And I will mention, too, that we still have federal laws. Federal agencies are still able to conduct the business that they need to do. They're not necessarily bound by the warrants that we issue here in Minnesota. So if there was something as serious as a federal crime that needed to be addressed with a no-knock warrant, I would highly recommend that we work with our federal partners on something like that.
Representative Whitty.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. So would federal agents be able to execute a no-knock warrant in the state of Minnesota?
Representative Pern.
To my knowledge, they would still be able to, because I believe in the language it is that we can't authorize the issuance of a no-knock warrant in Minnesota. So if that were to be issued by a federal agency, I don't know how the state would supersede that.
Representative Whitty.
I guess no-knock warrants, I don't know how long you're an officer for, but it is scary being on that other side of the door. And that's the inherent risk that you take to protect and serve. No-knock warrants can be a useful tool for police. Can it get overused? Yes, on certain cases. But a no-knock warrant also then requires you to announce that when you're in there, who you are. And the difference would be a knock on the door where you're putting officers at jeopardy and then announcing to go in. And I guess the thing that confuses me is you say we can wait outside. Well, you're going to tie up a whole police department for 5-10 hours waiting for someone to leave. And I get there's other opportunities, but I do think this is a useful tool that can be probably scrutinized a little bit more through the courts, because they are given by an independent person. So I guess if federal agents are able to use them in our state, is it really going to make things safer, and we're just restricting them from our own police officers, who we just heard that we're trying to also help as they go through PTSD, where this is going to probably create more of that issue for them? Thank you.
Representative Pern.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Whitty. And I appreciate your perspective on this. I really do. And I know that there are going to be things that we agree to disagree on here. And this is going to be one of them. But I will say I don't necessarily agree that this will pose any greater threat or greater indication of PTSD in officers. The intent certainly is to move away from that. And while absolutely, you know, I do think we need to take this tool off the table. I don't think that just because we have a tool that we should be using it. You know, I don't use a hammer to fix my laptop. So, you know, there are things that sometimes we start to overuse or misuse. I'm not suggesting that these are all misuses. But what I'm saying is this was at one time an idea that may have worked in specific situations. In my mind, and what I'm here to testify to today, and hopefully gain support behind, is the idea that this is not worth it. The outcome here is not worth it. They are not. We have 417 agencies in the law enforcement agencies in the state of Minnesota. 35 of them applied for no-knock warrants. We're talking small numbers here. So, yes, they're used for a specific reason, but I will point out that of the 132 no-knock warrants that were applied for and issued, only 4 of them related to murder or manslaughter. Everything else had to do with evidence, drugs, something like that. And in those 4 cases that had to do with a very serious violent crime, only 2 of those were successful in getting the evidence or the person that they were there to get. So the quick math there is a 50% success rate when we're going after somebody violent with a no-knock warrant. Those odds are terrible. And I would remind the committee again that one loss of life is one too many. And seriously consider if there's a number in your head at which point you would become uncomfortable, because that number for me is 1.
Representative Navani.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Subject's been very well discussed, and points have been made on both sides, many of which I agree with. As one of 2 people at the table that have actually done warrants and done numerous no-knock warrants and been a team leader that decided if we would apply for one or not. It's not something that was ever taken lightly. You used the statistic that out of 132 no-knock warrants, only four were for a murder suspect. Is that right? Okay. If they're going just for evidence, you might have an argument. But the people on the other side of the door don't necessarily know what you're doing the search warrant for. They know that they're in trouble. They know that if they're caught for any of the various situations that they're maybe involved with, they could be going to jail for a long time. They know what they've done. Even if the police officers doing the search warrant don't know. This is a state that has concurrent sentencing, not consecutive. If they know they've committed several murders and the cops are there for them, they a lot of times have nothing to lose. And a lot of times, well, I don't know, a lot of times, I'll take that back. Just personally, I know that people have tried to do suicide by cop in that situation because they don't want to go to jail. Addressing Representative Holland's concerns about being at the door and them knowing what's going on. Think about one particular warrant we did as a no-knock. It was a meth lab that was active. Other people were in the house. And as was usually the case with the meth labs, they had two large, very aggressive dogs. We did it as a early morning warrant to get him sleeping. But he sicked the dogs on us. I was one of the first through the door with the less lethal shotgun because of the threat of the dogs. And he did sick the dogs on us. And after the dogs were dealt with, as he ran to the back bedroom and reached behind a headboard and was grabbing a shotgun. And he knew we were there. He knew that when he sicked the dogs on us. He was willing to go down in a fight, but he didn't have time because I was able to deal with the dogs because of the less lethal shotgun that I had. So when it comes down to it, you talk about there's not one life you're willing to risk, and we've seen situations just in the last couple of months where officers have been shot through the door. There was an incident down in, I believe, McLeod County just a couple months ago where they were shot through the door. And that's something that, you know, yeah, it's not something anyone takes lightly. And it is calculation, and you do the best you can. Whenever we did a no-knock search warrant, we always did our best to have some kind of a distraction. Maybe, if we were going to be going in the front door, we'd throw a distraction device in the backyard because we knew these people and we knew what they were capable of. We knew how their house would be hardened, how hard it would be to get through the front door. So that was something we always took into consideration. They need to be rare. They need to be safe. And they should be legal. The numbers, I think, speak for themselves that the departments are taking it seriously, and they have cut way back on them. We have the mandatory reporting. We have the oversight now. I think it's important. I think it's important to have this tool. You say it's a tool that we don't need. I carried a tool on my hip for 33 years that I prayed to God I never needed. But if I did need it, I would have been glad I had it. And because one life I'm not willing to risk is important to me, I'm going to stand up. I encourage my members to vote no on this. And, Madam Chair, I request a roll call. Thank you.
Yeah. And before we move to closing remarks, I just want to, for the record, to make clear that we do have consecutive sentences in Minnesota. We have a multiple victim exception, and as a prosecutor, it is very rare that I would ever see a case with multiple victims with injuries, anything like that, where we wouldn't have consecutive sentences. Most of them, in fact, I would guess probably are consecutive sentences. With that, to your closing comments, please.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, committee, for the discussion. I appreciate all of the thoughtful questions. This is a serious issue, and like I said, it's certainly not the most popular one, and I'm well aware of that. But I really do think that that if we start to think about the way that we pursue justice in a different way, where we don't have to barge in right now. If there is an emergency, we can already do that. If somebody is in danger, we are going to do everything we can to save them. That's not at issue here. The other thing that is not at issue here is the inherent, we're talking about, you know, the inherent danger of serving any warrant. But that's a system that we have in place, and we have to work within that system. If we can peel back a portion of it, that allows us to do safer work, I think that is worth it. I truly do think that is worth it. And that's why I'm bringing this bill forward and changing the language, because you know, we're not talking about eliminating warrants completely. We know that everything that goes along with a warrant is going to stay in place. But what we can do here right now and in this session is take a step acknowledging that we don't always need to treat situations as emergencies when they really aren't, because we've seen what the outcome can be, and it's unacceptable. Thank you.
Thank you. And I just wanted to thank our members for a really robust and respectful discussion today. And again, thank you so much to Mr. Locke for being here. We appreciate it. With that, Representative Curran renews the motion that House File 2290, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. A roll call has been requested, and the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Moeller?
Aye.
Moeller, yes. Vice Chair Feist?
Aye.
Feist, yes. Representative Novotny?
No.
Novotny, no. Representative Becker Finn?
Aye.
Becker Finn, yes. Representative Curran?
Aye.
Curran, yes. Representative Ingen?
No.
Ingen, no. Representative Fraser?
Aye.
Fraser, yes. Representative Hollins?
Aye.
Hollins, yes. Representative Hudson?
No.
Hudson, no. Representative Mueller?
Mueller votes no.
Mueller, no. Representative Pinto?
Aye.
Pinto, yes. Representative Tapke?
Aye.
Tapke, yes. Representative Witte?
No.
Witte, no. With 8 ayes and 5 nays, that concludes the roll call vote.
There being 8 ayes and five nays, the motion prevails. All right, we're going to switch things up, members, on the agenda with the order, and we're going to move next to House File 2173. That's a Representative Becker Finn bill. And I believe Representative Becker Finn's motion will be that House File 2173 be recommended to be placed on the General Register. Members, I'm not going to have any voice by the time we're done on Friday. I don't know how I'm going to do it. Is that your motion, Representative Becker Finn?
Yes, Madam Chair, and that's why you have a vice chair.
That's right. She's ready. And I see that you do have an A1 author's amendment. Would you like to explain your amendment, please?
Yes, Madam Chair, and I would move the A1 amendment. So the statutes around tribal law enforcement are kind of messy, and there are some tribes have their own standalone section of statute, and we just wanted to include unintentionally left out the Lower Sioux Indian community in this larger conversation and want to include them.
All right, is there any discussion to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails and the A1 amendment is adopted. Now, if you can go ahead and explain your bill as amended.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you everybody who attended the breakout section session during Sovereignty Day, where we actually ended up discussing this issue and this bill quite thoroughly. So essentially the way things stand right now is if there is a tribal police department, which to remind folks, the Tribal Police Department, their peace officers are fully licensed in the state of Minnesota, just like any other peace officer in the state. However, the way that current statute is that Tribal Police Departments are required to have an agreement with the local counties in order for them to exercise state jurisdiction over things that happen within reservation boundaries. Cities, townships, they're not required to do that. They just automatically are given the full respect and treated as other licensed peace officers in the state. But if you're working for a tribal police department, they're currently treated differently. And so we're trying to remove barriers so that we have more licensed peace officers enforcing the law in our state, and especially in our rural areas where most of our tribal communities are located. And with that, I have several testifiers, including some folks who've traveled to be here, and I think it's important that we make sure we have time for them.
Yeah, great. So do I. Thank you. And the first person I have on our list is Solicitor General Kayla Dog Eagle. And then next on the list will be Chief of Police James West. So if you want to make your way down as well to be ready. Welcome so much to the committee. If you could introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. It's an honor to be here. As the chair stated, my name is Caleb Dog Eagle. I'm the Solicitor General for the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe. And it's my pleasure to provide brief testimony on this. I know we have several folks here to testify, and we're getting into the evening. So, in the 1950s, Public Law 280 transferred federal criminal jurisdiction on most Indian reservations in Minnesota to the state. In 1991, Mille Lacs worked on a bill that became a law, Minnesota Statute Section 626.90. It was the first law on a PL 280 Minnesota reservation that provided an Indian tribe could appoint peace officers and exercise state law enforcement authority. Under the law, the peace officers appointed by the band had to be post-certified and were paid by the band, and the band had to waive immunity and agree to be responsible for torts committed by its officers and to purchase insurance for them. The officers would refer suspects accused of violating state law to the county attorney for prosecution. 626.9 states that the band shall enter into a cooperative agreement with the county sheriff. The first such agreement was entered in 1991, shortly after the law was passed. With one brief interruption in 2008, the law and these agreements worked well for the next 25 plus years. Tribal and county police work side by side. However, the cooperative agreement requirement is an affront to tribal sovereignty and has long outlived its usefulness. Although tribal police departments were in the infancy back in 1991, they have evolved over the past 30 years into sophisticated, highly trained, and well-funded law enforcement agencies. Many law enforcement agencies, including city police departments, county sheriffs, state patrol, and other state enforcement agencies and federal law enforcement agencies commonly exercise concurrent jurisdiction with no requirement that they enter into cooperative agreements. There's no reason to treat tribal police departments differently. The cooperative agreement requirement is not only unnecessary, as I stated before, it's an affront to tribal sovereignty, and it is subject to abuse. As you will hear from the Chief of Police from Mille Lacs Tribal Police Department, James West, in a moment, the band has experienced this firsthand. I want to highlight a few things that this bill doesn't do. It's not going to change any jurisdiction of any state agency. It's not going to change the band's jurisdiction at all. It doesn't change the band's police officers' jurisdiction or their authority or the oversight over them. State violations will continue to be submitted to the proper prosecuting authority, which is the county. The bill does strengthen tribal, strengthen the tribe's ability to regulate the laws within their territories to protect all citizens that come to our territories. It eliminates the risk for a county to potentially abuse the requirement of a cooperative agreement. Most importantly, the bill recognizes and respects the sovereignty of the Mille Lacs Band and every other tribe. Thank you for this opportunity to testify before you.
Thank you for your testimony. We appreciate you being here. Next, we have Chief of Police James West, and on deck, we have Secretary Treasurer Michael LaRock. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is James West, Chief of Police for the Mille Lacs Band. I don't want to sound repetitive, but my some of the topic stuff I have is so similar to what Solicitor General Doggill had stated. So I have 23 years experience within the state of Minnesota, 20 years with the Mille Lacs Band. My testimony is in support of the proposed modification to the requirements within state statute 62690 through 62693 regarding tribal law enforcement to exercise concurrent law enforcement jurisdictional authority. To give a brief background on the Mille Lacs Band's law enforcement, the band's police department was established in 1984 with one officer. Mille Lacs Band gained state law enforcement authority and the ability to appoint licensed peace officers in 1991 under the current structure of Statute 62690. I will agree there were some inexperience and lack of resources during the initial development of the Mille Lacs Band's police department in the early 1990s, as the Mille Lacs Band had for some time relied on state and local law enforcement within our communities. I will say in the past 32 years, the Mille Lacs Band's police department has developed into a robust and progressive department with educated, experienced, and highly trained sworn licensed peace officers. Currently, we employ 21 sworn licensed officers who enforce tribal, state, and federal laws throughout Mille Lacs, Pine, and Aiken counties. Our officers respond to an average of 9,000 calls for service per year on land and water. Our licensed officers go above and beyond the minimum training requirements set forth by the Peace Officer Standard and Training Board. To mention a couple, they include cultural sensitivity training, crisis intervention training through the Barbara Snyder Foundation, and patrol online training through the Minnesota League of Cities. The Mille Lacs Band Police Department also has a Department of Natural Resources Enforcement Division with several airboats, snowmobiles, all-terrain vehicles, and is dedicated to the search and rescue operations along with several youth training programs. Our police department has two canine units, an unmanned aerial drone team, a police explorer program, a highly trained tactical entry team, a dispatch communication center, computer-aided dispatch, and independent records management system with a direct connection to the state's criminal justice data network. We continue our partnerships with many state, local, and federal partners and affiliate with task forces to include the Human Trafficking Task Force through the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, partner with Missing and Murdered Indigenous Relatives and Trust, Tribes United Against Sex Trafficking. We've been affiliated with drug task forces in the past, including the East Central and North Central Gang and Drug Task Forces, and our former police chief was city member of the Minnesota Police Board. On several occasions, our investigations lead outside our jurisdiction. We have and continue to partner with other agencies throughout the state, including several multi-county drug task force teams, the BCA, many metro area police and sheriff's departments, U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency, U.S. Postal Service, Federal Bureau of Investigations, Bureau of Indian Affairs, Homeland Security Administration, and Department of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. Our police department has a great partnership and rapport within our communities. We are devoted to community policing and understand the importance of traditional values, beliefs, and culture that gives our community strength. What I've just mentioned shows the Mille Lacs Band's development and growth within its police department and the competency level that is well above the standard here in Minnesota. It is equally important to mention the main reason for modifying the statutes, which is our experience of a county revoking a cooperative agreement and terminating a tribe's ability to enforce state laws within its community. In 2016, we had 32 police officers in our department. During the revocation of the cooperative agreement in Mille Lacs County, we lost many functions to maintain public safety for our community. In a flip of a switch, we no longer had a dispatch. Our state armor radios were programmed to the same standard as an EMT or firefighter radio, leaving us without adequate communication with other law enforcement agencies. We were given a protocol outline that threatened arrest for impersonating a peace officer if we attempted to exercise their state law enforcement authority. We essentially had to hand over our abilities to effectively provide public safety in our own community to the local sheriff's office. Proactive and progressive policing in turn went to reactive response policing and ineffective public safety. During a time when opioids and overdoses were starting to hit our communities hard, our police department had to take the sidelines and watch as nothing could be done. Officers still responded for service. If we were able to intercept the police radio traffic, officers responded to at least show community members that we're still here and to exercise our tribal inherent authority. But even as officers attempted to exercise our inherent authority, our investigations were interrupted by deputies and our officers were humiliated. This was a horrific and terrifying experience, which lasted for a period of 2 years. No law enforcement agency should have to go through this experience like we did. Lastly, I just want to point to the fact that any law enforcement agency in the state of Minnesota that has concurrent jurisdiction is not required to have a cooperative agreement to exercise their state law enforcement authority. For instance, Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport Police Department, the Metro Transit Police, University of Minnesota, and University of Minnesota Duluth Police. And there's only 8 or 9 exceptions to this, and that's the police agencies here in the Minnesota. These 9, now 8, as Prairie Island is now exempt, have their state law enforcement authority dictated by the local county in which they share concurrent jurisdiction. The power to authorize state law enforcement authority should not rest in another local unit of government. This power should rest at the state level. This decision is yours. It's in your hands. I hope you see that the current statutes regarding tribal law enforcement are outdated and need revision. It's time to recognize and respect tribal nations for the sovereign governments they are and to be treated fairly and consistently with all other units of government. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for being here. Thanks for your testimony. Next up, we have Secretary Treasurer Michael LaRock and then Police Chief John Preem after that. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin.
Ani Bujou, Mike LaRock. I'm the current Secretary Treasurer of the White Earth Nation. I'm a retired Director of Public Safety, Chief of Police for the White Earth Nation. Basically, I'm here just to support this bill, and thank you for giving me the time to speak and testify here today. I was going to go over some of the stuff that the chief that was talking before me, but those are some of the examples about what all tribal police departments have. We all have what they have. We have not, if not equal, or even better training, equipment, and stuff like that for tribal police departments. And what this bill, we're looking at this bill. It's been a couple of years since when, and I've been retired for about 10 months now. And looking at it, and the reason why I'm here to testify is because I have a lot of extensive knowledge on what we were talking about with the bill in the past and why we need this statute change. The White Earth Nation works within Becker County, Clearwater County, and Mahnomen County. We encompass the total Mahnomen County as far as our jurisdiction and our border lines for it is. And I want to just express that there's worst case scenarios and there's good case scenarios. With the Mille Lacs testimony, it shows you that what worst case scenario could be. With White Earth Nation, we've always had really good relationships with all three sheriffs, but that could always change. That could change in a heartbeat. In an election, it can change. It can change under these cooperative agreements. They can get out of the agreement and take 28 police officers that we have at the White Earth Nation and just null and void them. And how detrimental that would be to public safety on the White Earth Nation. So that's why this bill is so important for us to get done. And I know that it's a small statute change where it goes from may to shall, and it changes it to give us a level playing field along with all the other state agencies, just like we required that we need as far as tribal law enforcement agencies. Basically, what I'm going to talk about now is just a little bit about the jurisdiction stuff like that, and let you know what actually happens when a tribal agency is responding to calls. When we respond to calls, we get in, like the Chief West had mentioned, is when we get there and we're the first ones on the scene, and oftentimes we have a larger department than some of the county agencies, and we're working later than them. So I'll give you another instance with one of the county agencies. They only provide coverage till like 2:30 morning, and then they're on call the rest of the time. We provide 24/7 coverage for our area. And when we get to the calls on some instance like this here, they'll turn around and the county agencies will jump in there and tell us that we can't handle it, and they'll take it over us and stuff like that. When we can, we have the capabilities and the training and the level playing field to be able to do that call and run with that call, get it to the county attorney, get the conviction on it, stuff like that. So those are just those little things that we have been experiences since we've been there. But like I said earlier, is that there's worst case scenario and there's really good case scenario. With us, it's been working out really good. When I started 18 years ago with the White Earth Nation Police Department, we did not have a cooperative agreement with the Clearwater County Sheriff's Department because they had a sheriff that had some kind of he had something against the tribal police department that he didn't want to get into a cooperative agreement with. So we were unable to go up and enforce any state law for our members and the citizens of Clearwater County in our area. Soon as that sheriff retired, the new sheriff that came in, his very first thing that he did was get into the cooperative agreement with us. And we've been working very well since then. So, but that possibility of that worst case scenario is what we really, really, really are kind of scared of with a tribal police department. So if we can't do our job and be very cooperative and very collaborative with the county agencies, we can't get nothing done. I heard some testimony earlier and some other things about retention and recruitment of officers. We all know that that's really, really a problem here in the state of Minnesota and across the country. With this bill, we'd be able to level the playing field, along as with when people come to work for us and they say that we're under a cooperative agreement with the counties and they know that it could be extinguished at any time. They don't want to stay with us and they go jump on to other departments and all that. So it makes it tough for us to retain officers and stuff like that. So with this bill changing, we would be able to retain our officers, stay on the same level playing field. Miigwech.
Thank you. Thanks so much. Next up, we have Police Chief John Preem. Welcome, and please introduce yourself, and you can begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Good evening. My name is John Preem. I'm the Chief of Police for the Prairie Island Tribal Police Department. It was my 29th year working as a peace officer in Minnesota, actually as of this week. For the last 19 years, I've worked at Prairie Island. We're the official police department of the Prairie Island Indian Community, a sovereign tribal nation located in Goodhue County. For context, Prairie Island Tribal Police Department was established in 2003. The police chief and the first two officers were hired in early 2004. Today, we have an authorized strength of 14 licensed peace officers and a community service officer. Three of our officers are tribal members. Our officers are all licensed by the State of Minnesota Board of Peace Officer Standards and Training, and this means that we're required to have the same training, education, and testing as any other licensed peace officer in the state of Minnesota. I'm here today asking for your support of the proposed modifications to the requirements within state statutes 626.90 to 626.93. Specifically regarding tribal law enforcement's ability to exercise concurrent law enforcement jurisdictional authority. Madam Chair and members, imagine if the city that you reside in was mandated to sign a cooperative agreement with the surrounding county sheriff's department as a condition of establishing that police department. Couldn't exist without. Imagine that the county decided to rescind that agreement and essentially prevented the city from serving its citizens' public safety needs. It sounds absurd, but that's entirely the situation that we see today with the current language. No local unit of government would operate that way, and none in Minnesota are required to, except the sovereign tribal nations covered under the existing law. In fact, according to the Minnesota Post Board website, there are currently 418 law enforcement agencies in Minnesota, and of those, currently only the eight tribal nations, are subject to the requirement of having a cooperative agreement in order to exist. Originally, there were nine. As pointed out previously, there was an exception made for Prairie Island in 2019 when Senate File 1100 passed. And at that time, we heard a lot of concerns about how the language and removing the requirement might affect policing in Minnesota as far as tribal agencies were concerned. I'm proud to say that in almost 4 years since Senate File 1100 passed, none of the concerns brought up have come to fruition. For example, the change in language did not limit or reduce the jurisdiction of any other state, county, or local agency. It didn't extend or alter the tribe's jurisdiction or that of its police officers, or reduce the amount of oversight for our tribal police officers. What has happened since Senate File 1100 passed? Well, in our case, our cooperative agreement with Goodhue County and the city of Red Wing is still in place, as it has been since 2004. We still continue to have a strong relationship with both the city of Red Wing and with Goodhue County. We also continue to have strong relationships with Dakota County and the city of Hastings, and we rely on them quite frequently for mutual aid. But perhaps most importantly, I think we've shown that the Prairie Island Indian community has the capabilities and resources to protect its community and enforce state laws on tribal lands. We have good working relationships with a number of law enforcement agencies. These cooperative relationships are the foundation of public safety. They're built on trust and mutual respect, not on mandates. The proposed change is about fairness and equity, and it's time to change the law and recognize and respect the tribal nations for the mature, responsible governments that they are. I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you today.
Thank you. Thanks so much. And I believe that's it for your testifiers. I just want to thank all of you for taking the time to travel here and be here to testify. We did not have anybody from the public sign up, so we'll move on to member discussion. Lead Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Moeller. I've got a question for Chief West, if he's still available.
All right. Go ahead and ask your question while he's coming down, please.
He described situations where the county is coming over and taking over calls, I believe. Was that you who described that situation?
So during the revocation period from 2016 to 2018, there was, I guess, numerous times where we were unable, due to them revocating our cooperative agreement, although we were still enforcing or trying to exercise our inherent tribal authority. Which gives us the ability to essentially provide law enforcement within the reservation, absence of any federal or state law enforcement authority. But there were several occasions during that time where if our officers begin an investigation with band members on the reservation, resulting with tribal law or tribal statutes that may have been violated, deputies would, upon their arrival, would cut our investigations short and start their own investigations.
Representative Devani.
Thank you, Chairman Wick. Thank you, Chief, for the clarification. I just wanted to make sure that this wasn't happening outside of that. When you had your agreement and you were what was the time you were? Was it 2016 to about 2018? Is that correct?
Yeah, it was during the revocation period.
Right.
Thank you, Chairman Wick. Chief West, was there a time outside of that withdrawal period that the county would come in and take over a case?
Typically not, no.
Representative Devani.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. One last question. You said that 2016 you had a sworn staff of 32, but you're only at 21 now?
Correct.
Okay. Is that because of shortages or?
Part of it's part of shortages, but we lost quite a few as time progressed without having a cooperative agreement in Mille Lacs County. Officers just decided to go elsewhere.
Representative Bobby.
Okay, so just for a clarification, and I'll be done, Chair Moeller, thank you. So is it, do you have open positions, or you just haven't filled from the pre-2016?
Since 2018, when we renegotiated a temporary agreement that's still set to expire. We've been posted on the post board and other avenues in attempts to recruit officers. So we do hire some officers. We do have officers that do leave some of the other departments. We had an investigator that left recently to the BCA. So yeah, we're trying to retain and recruit at the same time like any other agency is.
Representative Devani.
Okay, so if you could hire the people right now, would you have 32 on staff?
Close to that, if we could. We certainly have the positions open for those positions, yes.
Maybe I'm not asking it right. What's your authorized staff level right now? What's your authorized staffing?
Currently, I think we're at 28. Okay. We should be at 32. Obviously, over time, some of those positions were shaved from our budget. But if we can get to our max budget, the potential for appropriations to get those other positions back to where we were pre-2016.
Thank you, Chief. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chief.
Yep. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to take the time to say
the other day in Sovereignty Day, Speaker Ortman made the statement that it's not the responsibility of tribal sovereigns to educate us. And I thought about that, and I think that's right. And it makes me all the more grateful that they've been willing to, in spite of not having to. I've learned a lot I've learned more in the last month about tribal issues than in the entire previous time of my life, and maybe we should talk about that in our education committees. But I got to tell you, I'm really glad this is happening. It makes total sense. It's one of those things, kind of like the Family Preservation Act, where I heard about it and I learned the history, and I just kind of scrunched up my brow and thought, how is this a thing? And why did it take this long to fix it? So I'm glad it's in the process of being fixed. When I think about my own city, I live in a city that does not have a police department. It's too small for it. But it's a nice dynamic that we have with the sheriff, because he knows we could have a police department. And so it creates a nice little dynamic of customer service. Make sure that you're giving us what we're contracting for and keep us happy, and we won't have the need to create a police department. And so the idea that the tribal nations have been proceeding without that same sort of respect and balance of jurisdiction, well, it's a problem, and I'm glad we're solving it. So thank you.
Closing comments, Chair Feckerfin.
I just want to also point out that we've had, obviously folks know I'm Leech Lake myself, and there is a letter from the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe. They have testified in the past. But we spread the love and had some other tribes step up, and we're willing to testify. The idea with this is that we've been having this conversation about different tribal communities and different tribes for many years, and you know, we sort of negotiated down to just getting the exception for Prairie Island, and we're trying to finally do this right and do right by all of our tribal nations, and that's why this bill right now. Finally, just as an example, in my home community of Cass Lake, the city lost the ability to fund a police department. The Leech Lake Police Department is our police department in the city of Cass Lake. And folks who are used to living in rural areas, you might wait a long time for the state patrol or the sheriff's deputy to show up. And you're darn glad, whether you're a tribal member or not, that the Leech Lake Police Department is there when you need them. And so we think that they need to be held to the same respect and esteem as everybody. This costs the state nothing, and you get more officers out in our communities enforcing state law. It's a no-brainer, and I am really happy that we can finally move this forward this year, and appreciate all the testifiers and folks who traveled, as well as the discussion both before the committee and this evening.
And with that, Chair Beckerfin renews her motion that House File 2173, as amended, be recommended to be placed on the general register. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. The motion prevails. Thank you.
Right.
Okay. I'll power through. Yeah, tomorrow may be a different story, but I'll power through. Okay, next we're going to move Representative Pinto's bill, which is House File 2322. And members will be confining the discussion of this bill. If folks leaving, especially because I have no voice, if folks leaving can be quiet, please. I can't talk any louder. members, we're going to be confining the discussion of this bill to the provisions that deal only with the Department of Public Safety and the transfers to the new department. Representative Pinto, I believe your motion is to move House File 2322 to be re-referred to the Committee on Children and Families, Finance, and Policy.
That is my motion, Madam Chair.
And there are no amendments. So, Chair Pinto, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. The House File 2322 would put us on the path of having a Department of Children, Youth, and Families. This is a proposal from the Walz Flanagan administration. It's one that I'm really, really excited about. As the chair referenced, our committee's jurisdiction is pretty limited relating to this, but I think maybe the best thing, Madam Chair, is just to have Assistant Commissioner Bailey walk through just a little bit of context for the proposal and also the piece that connects with our committee.
Thank you. Thank you. So we'll move then to Commissioner, Assistant Commissioner Bailey, if you can introduce yourself for the record and begin. And please be mindful of the fact that we do have another bill we need to wrap up tonight. So if there's anything you can race through, we'd appreciate it. Go ahead.
Chair Mueller, and members of the committee, Aaron Bailey, Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Minnesota Management and Budget and Executive Director of the Governor's Children's Cabinet. I'm a little ahead of you. I'm going to skip my talking points and slides and turn it over to...
You're nervous when we saw a slideshow. Sorry.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. We've had many stops in this bill, Chair, so I'm getting better. I'll just touch on real briefly that I think we are in an extremely unique moment at being able to consider this proposal that really brings Minnesota more in line with states across the country in terms of creating a Department of Children, Youth, and Families. I think specifically within this committee, want to highlight the fact that centering youth voice, I think, is important, that we are hearing from young people and, frankly, hearing from some of you around the table about desire for program strategies that focus on youth and how sometimes those need to be outside of our particular systems. And we've created a system here in the state government where leaders are committed and firmly believe that the time is now and we have an opportunity here. So grateful for the time. The proposal, just really briefly, creates a transition process with a new commissioner not being appointed until July 1 of 24, but a transition process working between July 1 of 24 through the next 2 years that would move core programs really within this committee's jurisdiction is the Office of Youth Justice housed at the Department of Public Safety. And with that, I will turn it over to the commissioner.
All right. Thank you. Commissioner Bob Jacobson, welcome back. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Good evening, Chair Mueller, members of the committee. I'll make this as brief as I can. I've been blocking out paragraphs already as we speak. But again, for the record, Bob Jacobson. To get it out, the Department of Public Safety supports the work of the Juvenile Justice Advisory Committee to maintain compliance with federal protections designed to keep kids in the juvenile justice system and reduce ethnic and racial disparities. This is big work. It's important work. I formerly worked at the Department of Human Services, and I know the challenges of our youth and families are facing. And over the past 4 years, the Department of Public Safety has seen the benefits of the cross-collaboration and connections forged by the Children's Cabinet in leveraging expertise and resources across agencies to better support youth throughout the state of Minnesota. The proposed Department of Children, Youth, and Families institutionalizes that approach by placing the work of the Juvenile Justice Advisory Committee and Youth Justice Office alongside similar state agencies. And so this new department could assist Minnesota's youth-serving organizations in accessing information, applying for grant funding, resulting in increased availability of and access to community-based services aimed at enrichment, therapy, recreation, education, engagement, rehabilitation, and other prevention and intervention approaches. And no matter what you decide, DPS is committed to continuing the work towards ensuring that youth and families remain supported in Minnesota and to invest in the prevention and intervention alternatives to keep Minnesota youth from ever coming into contact with the juvenile justice system. And with that, I will end it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thanks so much. We did not have any members of the public sign up to testify, so we'll move now to member discussion. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I said quite a bit the last time I sat on a committee where this bill was heard in the Children and Families Committee. Tonight's a little bit different, obviously, given the jurisdiction of public safety, but it was brought to my attention by a resident, some concern regarding the provision in 731, I'm guessing through 812 perhaps, regarding data sharing and coordination and innovation. The concern that was raised was, you know, in 731 it says the commissioner may have access to data of any classification held by the commissioners of, and then it lists off all of the departments that are going to be consolidated, as it were, under this new Department of Children and Families. The concern was that under the existing departments, some of this information is considered, it's classified in such a way as to not be accessible unless there's particular reason for it to be accessed, and that the wording in 731 of the commissioner may have access to data of any classification, that regardless of intention, this might create a scenario where data that under these other existing departments would have been private and not subject to public scrutiny would suddenly become available to agency staff. Is that something that's been considered or looked at, or what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, and before I just turn it over to you, I'll note that Chapter 13 is judiciary civil law jurisdiction, and we did have some discussion on that, but I'm happy to turn it over to Representative Pinto for him to answer that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, on the, so the bill did pass through judiciary, so essentially got that blessing, but the folks around there will recall there was a discussion about this provision, and I had committed to continuing conversations. Actually, I had a meeting with Representative Scott earlier this week, and there's a major amendment to this language coming that should go a long, long, long ways to addressing the concerns expressed. So, yeah.
Thank you.
Yep. Vice Chair Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And on the data point, that was a concern I had too, and we've had conversations, so I'm looking forward to that amendment too. I think it's going to be addressing those concerns. I just wanted to say how strongly I am in support of this, in particular because of why we're here in public safety. I think moving these programs, YIP and JJAC and the Youth Justice, Youth Justice Callie Hargett. I think that is just really important. I think we need to look at these kids as whole children and look at youth wellness, not just how do we like stop kids from being bad. And I think putting them in the context of this new department is exactly where we need to be. Just thinking about, like we've talked a lot about the dual status crossover youth, kids are involved in the child welfare system and the juvenile justice system. Like how do we meet all those needs? How do we address all of these things in a way that is coordinated? I was meeting recently with the Minnesota Corrections Association's juvenile justice team, and they were talking about this issue, that when they're trying to put all of these services together, that's kind of a constant struggle. So I think this is brilliant, and I'm super excited about it. Thank you.
Yeah. Closing comments, Chair Pinto.
And I should shout out to Representative Feist as well, because I was working with her on that data language, so thanks for raising that all. Folks, I think, are aware I come at things often from a young child perspective. I was the early childhood chair for a number of years, so excited about this proposal from that angle. But then the idea from our committee being able to bring in a youth justice perspective, I just think it's so powerful. I'm so excited about the proposal, and I would love your strong support today and beyond as well. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And with that, Chair Pinto renews his motion that House File 2322 be re-referred to the Committee on Children and Families. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Yeah.
All right, the next bill and final bill we have is House File 1836. It's a Representative Holland's bill. We'll be laying this over, therefore I move to lay over House File 1836. We do have an A1 amendment. Representative Hollins, would you like to move and explain your amendment?
Yes, thank you, Chair Mueller. I would like to move the amendment. What this amendment does is simply add that the training funding will contain blocks of instructions on racial disparities in the criminal justice system and collateral consequences to criminal convictions, and then it also includes a reporting requirement.
All right, and I see that we do have an amendment to the amendment, the A2 amendment. Who will be offering that? Uh-oh, he stepped away. Someone else want to jump in and his?
Just
someone else want to offer it? Representative Hudson, thanks for jumping in.
Given my pitch hitting role here, I'm just going to read it. It would delete line 1-4 and insert the impact of offender's crime has on crime victims. So, in other words, instead of looking at racial disparities in the criminal justice system and collateral, we're going to look at the impact of an offender's crime. My assumption is that Lee Devontae's intention here is to focus the intention of the bill on individualized outcomes from victims of particular crimes, as opposed to focusing so much on aggregate data and the focus on disparities.
All right, Representative Hollins on the A2.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Hudson, for jumping in there. I'm extremely sad that I don't get to do my quote for Representative Novotny, that the criminal justice system disproportionately impacts communities of color. But I know that he feels it in his heart wherever he is. And because of that, I would like to suggest that members do not support this amendment to the amendment. It doesn't really address what we know that we need to do and what we would like to require for the prosecutors in this situation. So I would recommend a no vote. Thank you.
Great. Any closing comments, Representative?
Sure. Given the opportunity to comment on the role of racial disparities in public safety, I'll just say that the concern that is kind of a universal evergreen concern on this side of the table when it comes to these things is that that the assumption is that folks are being treated differently based upon their racial characteristics, which would suggest that there's crimes that are taking place by white people that we're just okay with and aren't doing anything about, or that there are people who are totally innocent who are being subject to the criminal justice system unfairly. I don't think that's the case. I think that the reason for disparities in criminal justice is because there's a disparity in the commission of crime amongst racial groups. And I think that acknowledging that is really important if our objective is to actually do something about crime as opposed to trying to make ourselves feel good by achieving an aggregate number score. I imagine Lee Novotny would request a roll call on this, so I will go ahead and request a roll call, Madam Chair. Thank you.
All right, so we will have a roll call on the A2 amendment.
I got it.
Go ahead. Chair Mueller?
No.
Mueller, no. Vice Chair Feist?
No.
Feist, no. Representative Novotny?
Yes.
Novotny, yes. Representative Becker Finn?
No.
Becker Finn, no. Representative Curran?
No.
Curran, no. Representative Ingen?
Yes.
Ingen, yes. Representative Frazier?
No.
Frazier, no. Representative Hollins?
No.
Hollins, no. Representative Hudson?
Yes.
Hudson, yes. Representative Mueller?
Mueller votes yes.
Mueller, yes. Representative Pinto? Representative Tapke?
No.
Tapke, no. Representative Witte?
Yes.
Witte, yes. With 5 ayes and 7 nays, that concludes the roll call vote.
There being 5 ayes and 7 nays, the motion does not prevail and the amendment is not adopted. All right, so now we'll take a vote on the A1 amendment. All those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the A1 amendment is adopted. All right, now that we got the bill amended, please tell us about the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members. I really want to respond to Representative Hudson, but I'm not going to because time is short. I have carried this bill since I first came to the House, and it was brought to me by the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. We know that the importance of training for our justice system, our justice partners, is important, and it's crucial to have a well-functioning and capable justice system. Also, as we continue with the baby boomer retirement, we have the opportunity to assist new lawyers to hone their skills and learn the practical aspects of trial presentation and trial management. The resources in this bill will go towards supporting additional trial school and train the trainer courses. My fellow lawyers, especially those who have practiced in the public sector, can recall passing the bar, securing a job, and then being told you get to go to court tomorrow. And I experienced that in the private sector, too. And it's not fun and it's not easy. So I would like to turn this over to my testifier, who is the president of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association.
Great. Welcome, Michelle Zender Fisher. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Michelle Zender Fisher. I'm the president this year of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, and I also serve as the Nicollet County Attorney. Lucky for your time allotment, my other testifier today, Kristen Nelson, was not able to join us. So I will be appearing before you to, tonight. There are 87 county attorneys and roughly 800 assistant county attorneys in Minnesota. These attorneys are responsible for prosecuting cases, representing counties and county agencies, and protecting our most vulnerable of our communities in cases pursued through child protection, adult protection, and civil commitment actions. A county attorney's office is really the equivalent of a general practice law firm. To do that work, we need training and education on the diverse and sometimes esoteric issues that seem to arise on a daily basis. The need for training includes not only the legal work that we handle, but also must include information and education on the conditions that led to the individual and family involvement with the legal system itself. This includes understanding chemical dependency, mental health challenges, and child welfare issues. Most county attorneys and assistant county attorneys are from small offices with small budgets for training. Offices consist of only 3 to 4 attorneys. These officers are most in need of training opportunities. All county attorneys' offices are responsible for the same work, regardless of size. While larger metro counties have divisions and individuals that can specialize in tax law, civil litigation, commitments, child protection, and criminal prosecution, most offices, like my own, have one person responsible for all of these areas of law. To do our work well, to serve those in our communities, and to do justice, training is vital. For county attorneys and assistant county attorneys, the availability of equivalent continuing education programming is limited, as most continuing ed is geared toward criminal defense, and the availability of training for the other unique areas we handle is limited to non-existent. Therefore, as an association, we provide that training to our members. The training bill would allow MCAA to increase its training opportunities, especially for experiential learning opportunities. The pandemic greatly interfered with the on-the-job training that is integral to county attorneys' offices. I, too, shared the experience of starting and being told I was going to court. The pandemic resulted in a loss of opportunity for new attorneys to go to court and watch an experienced lawyer handle a case, then be handed a file and have an experienced attorney sitting next to them, helping them along and giving immediate feedback, and the opportunity to attend our trial school. It also greatly hampered law school training opportunities in motion practice and trial advocacy. These skills were taught and practiced by Zoom, which is not the equivalent of being in the courtroom. When I think back to my mock trial competition days and the Saturday mornings when I had practice at 8 a.m. and had to put on a suit, I did so because my coaches always said you have to play the role to do the role. Court training is no different, and those opportunities are vital to skill development and justice. The bill under consideration would increase MCAA funding for this vital training. I'm very proud of the training work done by MCAA with its strong staff and largely volunteer faculty. We generally do not pay for faculty, relying on talent within the association and affiliated organizations. The increase for need for training is compounded by increasing costs for that training in lodging, technology, and other costs. During the pandemic, we were able to pivot to some training online and conferences virtually, but we were not able to continue the valuable skills training at the trial school and other in-person training. The same period saw a large number of retirements and loss of attorneys with significant experience. Our trial school is a highly sought-after training opportunity. It gives lawyers the opportunities to do the trial school and then get the immediate feedback on substance and style. It's been absent for 2 years, and as I referenced, there is an even greater demand with so many new lawyers entering county attorneys' offices. Tied to the need for trial school is the need for trial school instructors. With retirements and turnovers, we need to develop solid trainers by offering train-the-trainer events. Again, we are fortunate to rely on volunteer faculty, but still have significant expenses for the faculty, meals, lodging, and mileage for those instructors. This training money allows us to increase offering for those skill courses. I would like to mention that in addition to our trial school, MCAA offers robust training that takes place over noon hours and day-long trainings targeted at specific topics. Hot topics include the new legislation, understanding the use of technology in our cases, Rule 20 changes in gap cases, and data practices. This funding would allow the association to ensure that our county attorney's office receive timely, vital, and necessary training for the diverse topics that we deal with on an everyday basis. A just and fair system requires that all parts of that system receive proper training. In your materials, we have a one-pager, which I will admit is more of a three-pager, as lawyers tend to do, that contains specific information and numbers, and I thank you for the opportunity to appear before you in support of House File 1836, and I would be happy to answer any questions you might have. Thank you.
Thank you, and thanks for being here this hour of the night. We appreciate you waiting to testify, too. Thanks so much. We did not have anyone sign up in advance to testify on this bill, so we'll move to member discussion.
Right, leave the podium. Thank you, Chair Moeller. I would just like to say that although I am not licensed to practice in the law in the state of Minnesota or any other state for that matter.
thanks for that clarification.
I was proud to carry this bill last year, and I was proud to be asked to be the second signer on this bill. Part of the inspiration for me wanting to be active in this bill, my county attorney, Kathleen Haney, is here. Kathleen Haney had a program that she started when she was there with quarterly, in the same way that this bill is teaching county attorneys and assistant county attorneys in a program. She instituted a program where the county attorneys would give quarterly training to law enforcement officers, and I really saw the value of ongoing in-service training as we go, and I believe this is a good bill, and I ask for a yes vote.
And I'll say that I am licensed to practice in Minnesota, and I attended trial school over 20 years ago now, but I attend regularly MCAA trainings, and I've also presented before at those trainings, and I know that your program is excellent. Any closing comments, Representative Hollins?
Sure, just really quickly. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members. I guess what I realize as I'm sitting here listening is that if you didn't go to law school, you probably don't know that law school is like 3 years of the philosophy of law and not really anything on the practical aspects of practicing law. So this is really critical, especially when we want our public sector lawyers to be doing a good job and representing everybody well. So I would appreciate your support. Thank you.
All right. And with that, I will renew my motion and lay over House File 1836 as amended. Members, that concludes our agenda for the day, and we have our regularly scheduled meeting tomorrow morning. We are adjourned.